Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the next hour. Back with me today is Mr. Riley Wagaman, beaming in from Tbilisi, Georgia. You can find Riley's work at his Substack, edwardslavsquat.substack.com, as well as at offguardian.org and unlimitedhangout.com. Riley, how are you, brother?
Jesse, my friend, I'm all right. How are you doing?
I am doing all right as well, all things considered. I know we are going to talk about the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which took place last week, but what's been one of the things that's been foremost on my mind is the alleged peace deal that was signed last March or April. The date is up in the air between Russia and Ukraine. I'm sure you're well aware of this.
Oh, yes. In fact, I recorded a podcast with Rollo about it yesterday, which should be up soon.
That's excellent. I look forward to that. And I don't want to preempt that, but I'm interested in your thoughts, summary of your thoughts, if you will, at this point. What do you make of it, this flashing of the document that Putin recently performed and the discrepancy between the late March date and the mid-April date, and so many other questions about this, the timing of Putin flashing it and revealing what he revealed. To me, it seems like a PR stunt, but perhaps there's much more to it. I don't know.
It's such a curious episode, and there's so many aspects to it. I mean, a lot of missing details, let's put it that way. And we could probably talk about this for the rest of the hour, which I would be happy to do, but maybe we shouldn't do that. But just my initial reaction to it was, you know, the episode was, from what I could tell, Jesse, maybe you have a different, maybe you saw something different, but the way that this was framed in sort of what I guess you could generally call pro-Russia English language media, especially on Twitter, was that this was another example of the collective West, or maybe specifically the UK, we don't really know, backstabbing Russia and pushing Ukraine and Russia into war and prolonging a conflict, which, by the way, I think is a perfectly legitimate viewpoint and quite a correct one. Of course, it doesn't tell the whole story. If this treaty is to be believed, if it's real, if what Putin said is correct. Because on the other hand, you have to ask, how is it that the Russian military was parked outside of Kiev and in several regions around Ukraine and decided to withdraw from these regions as part of a tentative agreement with the West, but then the other side didn't hold up the bargain? And like, what happened here, right? And like, my initial gut reaction is, how could this be possible if one of the main, at least according to the official story, if you listen to Putin's address on February 24th, 2022, he goes into great detail about how, look, he makes this argument that we tried Minsk 1, we tried Minsk 2, the West has not been a good faith negotiator. We feel compelled that we have to take action. So how can you launch into a military operation because you couldn't find a way to peacefully negotiate, only to get rugged by another negotiation, which apparently you had no insurance policy for? And that's what I don't right. get. And this is the thing, Jesse. I would love to get, maybe you have more thoughts or things you want to add to this, but my thinking here is, again, obviously a lot of this is conjecture. We don't know the full story, but if it's true that the Russian military withdrew as part of a peace agreement that was either in the works or about to be signed, and again, we don't know the exact timing of when this agreement was reached, as you pointed out earlier, like what this really would mean to us, if you think about it, is, oh my gosh, I think I've just totally lost my train of thought because this thing is so bizarre. What was I going to say?
Well, look, I think it's basically, you might have been.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go and I'll remember my thought.
Well, I think you were going in the direction of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the direction of, if that's the case, what you just explained, then Moscow was essentially admitting that its so-called special military operation had failed.
Oh yeah, okay, yes, which is a pretty big deal.
Right.
look, but yeah, okay, so not only did it fail, but it was the reason why, I mean, in theory, the reason why Moscow would agree to such a strange, like, you know, they would be like, okay, yeah, we will withdraw as part of a prerequisite to this agreement. The reason why they might do that, even though it sounds insane, is because they understood by basically the end of March or early April that the original intention of the special military operation had been unsuccessful. And I believe there's very strong evidence to show that the SMO really was an SMO. It really was supposed to be a special military operation. It wasn't supposed to be a conventional war. The idea was another Crimea-like, bloodless sort of regime change operation, right? Like a military psyop. Mm-hmm. It didn't work out. And that's a whole other subject, why it didn't, because I think there's many elements to that. And Rollo really dives into that when we spoke yesterday. But Moscow realized that there was no military objective, right? There was no way to use military force to get to achieve the political objectives. And so they said, well, I guess this is the best we can do. We'll withdraw mm-hmm. and we'll pray that the West will honor its side of the deal, which of course it didn't. And anyway, right. that's my initial take on it. I also just want to, as a disclaimer to, maybe there are listeners out there who are fuming at me, but I just want to say that's my honest assessment of the situation using the information that I have. And that's all I can do.
Yes, I agree. Again, so many questions, more questions than answers. I meant to say early April with regard to the date discrepancy. I was thinking of April 15th when I said mid-April. That's when Boris Johnson appeared in Kiev and allegedly scuppered Kiev's intent to agree to negotiate. And I say allegedly, not because I don't think Boris Johnson and the UK and the so-called collective West are capable of doing such, but because I don't know what actually happened. That's the story, the official, in inverted commas, story, but everything is, or almost everything is, alleged at this point.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that's what we have to remember when we talk about this war, and then to ask the question, why is just about everything about this war so strange. Why is it, for example, that Russia keeps getting fooled? It keeps trying to act in good faith, but it just keeps getting fooled. It's just so good and pure in its intentions, and it just wants to keep its good and pure intentions going, and it just keeps getting steamrolled, but it's going to keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result, which is, some would say, a definition of insanity. That doesn't add up. I don't think that the Russian political elites, because let's be real, they're who's running the show. The Russian political elites are, particularly the FSB, they're running the show. They're dictating, I argue, to the military what to do. And they're not stupid. They know what they're doing. They're calculated in what they're doing, as most, if not all, intelligence operatives and political elites affiliated with them are. So how do they answer for themselves that they keep getting fooled? Are they really just that stupid and that gullible? I don't buy it. But again, the bigger question, why is this Slav on Slav slaughter still going on? And I think we have to look to what it's enabling to happen globally in terms of a huge recalibration of the international monetary and financial system, that this is essentially a war for oligarchs, but above them, globalist bankers and financiers and the people who really pull the strings when it comes down to brass tacks. So those are some of my jumbled thoughts at the moment.
Yeah, really quickly, and then obviously we can move on, but I basically agree with everything you just said. And in fact, Roland and I, when we were discussing this very interesting and curious development, basically by the end of our conversation, which was many interesting twists and turns to it, we both just sort of agreed, so this is basically just an oligarch turf war, isn't it? And all this, you know, the fighting the Nazis or fighting the Moscow Russian imperialists is just this is just a sideshow for the proles. And we just listed all the different examples. For example, how on earth can what's most telling, of course, is that this peace settlement in Istanbul, where allegedly this very peculiar peace treaty was signed, had the very conspicuous presence of a gentleman named Roman Abramovich, who is a very prominent oligarch who lives in London and who, by the way, later loaded all those Azov prisoners onto his private jet and shipped them out of Mariupol. And we went through the whole list. How is it that Russia is in a, you know, existential war for its historical existence as a nation, and yet is still pumping the gas through Ukraine and selling its enriched uranium to the United States? And it's all because of its oligarchs. And Russia has become more and more obvious at this point. I mean, it was obvious pre-SMO, but now I don't know how anyone can deny it, that Russia is essentially, it's a group of oligarchs with a state and not a state with oligarchs, right? Yes. And so many of the confusing things, the things that make absolutely no sense, I don't care how hard you try to justify it, how much rationalization you do, there's no way for this to make sense. The only way that it makes sense is because Russia is being pumped dry. Its people are being exploited and basically at this point culled in many different ways. The same is true in Ukraine, absolutely, without absolutely no argument from me there. Slav versus Slav slaughter for the benefit of a handful of greedy slobs. And that's the SMO.
Yes. I will add, too, that it's quite curious to me that Putin decided to produce this revelation when he was speaking before the African Union delegation. I don't know exactly why. I don't know why he would choose to do that then. I can speculate.
Or do it, or why do it now specifically? Maybe also the date is important. I don't know. Yeah.
Right, right. But again, we're talking about people who are, they're not stupid. Putin's not stupid. He's not gullible. He's not naive. In some respects, he may be. I think when it comes to virology and so-called pandemics and so-called germs, he is. But that's for another conversation. But when it comes to political acumen, he certainly has it. And this was a calculated, I wager, a calculated move on his part, and perhaps a sales pitch to the African Union in line with this narrative about decolonizing Africa from neocolonialism, that's what Russia and China are going to help the African continent do, which if anybody's listened to a lot of my conversations with Issa Bloomy, that's far from what China in particular has been doing in Africa for quite some time. But again, it comes back to me to some kind of PR stunt in service of the oligarchs and the string pullers above them to whom they are beholden. And that's what makes the slaughter that's taking place even more grotesque than if we just look at this as a conventional geopolitical conflict. That's what makes it even more sickening to me that these brothers and sisters are being thrown against each other in a murderous way so that some kind of redistribution of elitist wealth on a global scale, not just on a regional scale, but a global scale, can take place.
Absolutely. Yep. It's what a mess. What a mess.
So speaking of that redistribution of elitist wealth on a global scale, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum took place last week from the 14th until the 17th. And you wrote two pieces about this, the first of which, and these are both at your Substack, the first of which is titled PCR Tests, Gene Therapy and Juicy Climate Gossip, Russia's Davos Kicks Off in St. Petersburg. And the second piece, which focuses more on one of the key Russian globalists, Erman Greff, is titled Friendly Banker Wants to Crash Russia's Economy by Replacing Bureaucrats with AI. Let's talk about the forum first. For those who don't know, what is this forum? And then what essentially went down this year, this round?
Well, it's basically Russia's Davos. That's the easiest way to describe it. I mean, it's an economic forum that gathers top heads of Russian industry so they can basically network with, you know, other global space lizards in their particular fields or lines of work. And so, for example, last year, Dr. Tedros from the WHO joined via video link, and there were other special guests. Even though the SMO was supposed to stop a lot of foreign guests from coming, some of them joined via web or in other ways or fashions. But basically, you're gonna find like the, you know, the, I guess it's called the business program. the business program every year at SPIEF is very, very similar to the discussion topics that you would see at any sort of Western creepy globalist conference, including Davos, right? And this year, by the way, even though COVID is, I mean, COVID in Russia for the average Russian was over in June 2020, right? But obviously it wasn't over for the Russian government. It's officially the WHO says that the pandemic is over. Yeah, I believe that was made. It was officially stamped as no longer a global health threat. Maybe 1 or 2 months ago, right? And but in order to get into the building at this fun conference in St. Petersburg, you had to take a PCR test. You had to pass a PCR test just to get into the door, get through the door, right? Which for me is just, it's embarrassing, you know, that
they need to keep collecting the biological material.
I guess so, Jesse. I guess so. It's the import substitution bio collection fund or whatever for Russia, now that they've been cut off from their dear Western partners. But look, it's
probably being sold on some biomaterial market somewhere.
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it for a minute.
For some sort of genetic mining. But
so yeah,
I was going to say in all seriousness, but that could very likely be happening at this point in time. Who knows? But in all seriousness, your point stands that this psychological operation, this terror operation known as COVID-19, it continues. No matter what the official messages are coming from the official health bodies, and I put official in inverted commas, and country, it's so embedded in nation states now that they're going to keep going with the operation, whether a global governance body is telling them to do so or not. And I think it's very telling that this happened at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, where you have globalists, the globalist elites coming together. And it's very telling that if you go to the SPIEF's official website, on the top menu, one of the pages you can click on, one of the featured pages you could click on, is COVID-19/PCR testing. To me, this is done to keep the operation going. It has nothing to do with safety or public health. It's to keep the psychological operation going, the terror campaign going. And Russia, as from the beginning, is still on board with this.
Yeah,
this murderous charade.
Exactly. And for me, it sort of serves as a metaphor or a reminder to everyone that yes, Russia and even, you know, other members of BRICS have very distinct cultural differences from the West. This is absolutely true. There are in fact differences between these two blocks, if that's what you want to call them, fine. But they're offering the exact same things, which is PCR tests and vaccines, digital IDs. And, you know, we can get into it a little bit, although I have to admit I haven't tried listening or finding transcripts for some of these discussions. But just go down the list of what they actually talked about at this conference. They talked about one of the topics of discussion was gene therapy embarking on the future today. I mean, it's like you can't get any creepier than this. And by that, I mean, it's just like anything else that, I mean, Klaus Schwab is probably, you know, I don't know what he's doing. I'm sure he's happy though. Like, why wouldn't he be?
Right. And on the Spieth's own website, it describes the expo as follows, in part as follows. One of the biggest and most important business events in the world. Over the past 25 years, the forum has cemented its status as a leading international event focusing on key issues in the global economic agenda. It provides a platform for participants to exchange best practices and expertise in the interests of sustainable development. Since 2005, it has been held under the auspices of the President of the Russian Federation, who has also attended each event. In 2021, SPIEF, or S-P-I-E-F, was the first business event of such magnitude to be held offline since the unavoidable break caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The forum was also notable for its use of cutting-edge digital technology. So this is something you could very easily read on the World Economic Forum's website, or
by the way, sorry, just to jump in here very quickly. I'm pretty sure our friend and colleague Ian Davis pointed out at one point, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, that in fact, SPIEF actually had a partnership with the World Economic Forum for many years, but that was probably at least formally broken off at the start of the SMO. But anyway, just wanted to add that.
Yes. So, and it's not just you and I who are pointing this out. Also, Katyusha, which is a pro-Putin, pro-SMO, Russian nationalist outlet, Russian language in the Russian language media ecosystem, if you will, pointed out a lot of what we're talking about in a very good critique published on the 14th of June, the day this kicked off, titled SPIEF 2023 has begun. This is the place where Storm Shadow will never be sent. They are all there. And it gets into a bunch, which you get into in your piece, and so perhaps we can overlap the two. But the title, for those who don't know what the Storm Shadow reference is, that's referring to missiles, and they're British. They're from the UK, Storm Shadow missiles, if I'm not mistaken. And what it's saying is that while the slaughter is going on, while the special military operation, so-called, is going on, here you have these globalists coming together in the lap of luxury and planning the future of the global economy, at least how they're going to participate in it, what they're going to contribute to it. And I would say not just the future, but the recalibration of the global economic and monetary system that is underway. And they don't have to worry about any storm shadows coming in or any other missiles coming in from Ukraine, because this goes back to the big picture we were talking about. This kind of organizing and planning and moving the bigger picture forward needs to continue uninterrupted, and the slaughter needs to continue in order to help this continue uninterrupted. And this is what all of us who care about what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Russia, need to understand, that this is the big picture we need to home in on. We can quantify what's happening all we want based on very murky data, but where is the qualifying of what's going on? Nobody in particularly Western alternative media seems very interested at all in qualifying any of this, because if you try to do it, then everything falls apart and it becomes a lot more complicated to explain, and a lot of pet theories and preferred narratives have to get thrown out the window. And that's uncomfortable for a lot of people to do. But I would say,
yeah,
disrupting your preferred narrative and getting uncomfortable is a small price to pay for trying to understand what this slaughter you claim to care about is really about.
And it's also a good way to steel proof your own arguments. If you feel very confident in your position on anything, you should be excited about exposing yourself to other perspectives so that, you know, you can make sure you've got all your bases covered, right? But anyway, I actually wanted to add in a little comment from a man whom I think we both have very mixed feelings on, but is nonetheless an important figure, especially today in Russia, a guy named Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of Wagner. And he actually released through his press service, someone asked him a question about what he thought of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And it's not a very long comment, but I think I want to read it in whole for your listeners, just because it's very Prigozhin-esque. And it's also actually, I think, quite eloquent. So this is what he said. Regarding the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, a friend of mine emailed me a series of photos from the internet, or rather collages. On the one hand, today's forum, and on the other hand, what is happening at the front. These are two different realities. What is happening today at the St. Petersburg Forum can be described as a feast during the plague. It has nothing to do with the economy. It has to do with the secular lifestyle and the parties that used to be in London. And he's right, though. I mean, look, Prigozhin is quite a character, and I'm not saying that all of his intentions are pure, but he's right.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. He is. And again, that's coming from a warlord.
An oligarch. Jesse, 2023 has really been, it's been a wild ride. Let's just put it that way.
Yes, it has been so far. And it's not even half over
we're only halfway through this ride.
Speaking of halfway through, let's take a quick pause, and when we come back, get into a little bit more detail about what went down at SPIEF, some of the things that were talked about, and what Erman Greff wants to do to the Russian people. As always, he has plans for the Russian people, and as you point out in your piece, they usually don't end up well. So let's get into that after this quick pause here on TNT Radio.
The World Economic Forum and Visa credit cards are coming for your cars.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
A World Economic Forum and Visa briefing paper is seeking a 75% reduction in cars globally by the year 2050. In a brilliant merging of corporate government collusion, Visa and the World Economic Forum want to reduce the number of vehicles from 2.1 billion to just half a billion. Visa Corporation's Chief Sustainability Officer, Douglas Sabo, helped write the foreword to the WEF briefing paper. The paper explains, quote, if we are to meet the needs and achieve the climate goals of the Paris Agreement, we recommend electrification, public transport, and shared mobility instead of vehicles. You will go nowhere and be happy. We must end the corporate government collusion and reject the World Economic Forum fully. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Nuclear power offers abundant, concentrated energy for the world, which is necessary to lift people out of poverty. Modern nuclear reactors are safe and provide power 24/7 without pollution. Today, the world is undergoing a nuclear power renaissance. As of March 2022, 56 large reactors are under construction worldwide in 17 countries. Planning approvals exist for 96 reactors, which are mostly expected to be in operation within the next 15 years. A further 325 reactors are proposed in 30 countries, with specific programs or sites. The Western media ignores this reality, as most of the planned and proposed reactors are for China, Russia, and India. While the United States has only two reactors under construction and three planned, China has 19 under construction and 34 planned.
This is
today's News Talk Radio.
After all, we got the best damn staff on the planet. Yeah!
TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. Just a quick housekeeping note. There is a delay in getting the recordings of each program up, but the TNT production team is hard at work remedying that delay. So hopefully the recordings for each show, not just mine, will be up ASAP. So in case you're wondering why they're not appearing on your preferred streaming platform, there is a slight delay, but again, it should be remedied in short order. I'm speaking with Riley Wagaman, independent writer, researcher, journalist, all around good guy who's based currently in Tbilisi, Georgia, and we're talking about the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which took place last week in St. Petersburg, Russia. Riley, you pointed out that some of the business program this year included things like presenting the results of the Russian Regional Investment Climate Index, gene therapy embarking on the future today, sustainable digital dialogue as a driver for a multipolar world, the climate agenda versus the climate agenda versus technological sovereignty, how to turn challenges into opportunities, and among others, digital dictatorship versus digital sovereignty, problems, risks, opportunities. Speaking of digital dictatorship, you wrote a piece, as I mentioned earlier, Friendly Banker Wants to Crash Russia's Economy by Replacing Bureaucrats with AI. The friendly banker here is none other than Erman Greff of Sberbank, or just Sber now. So what is this? I don't know what to call him based on this picture you have at the top of your piece, but what is this potentially wannabe cyborg up to now?
He's always up to something, Jesse. So first of all, I should point out that, yes, Sberbank is Russia's largest and partially state-owned bank, but it's really now it's Sber, which is it's basically an umbrella of various different subsidiaries and side hustles and projects. And so Sber is actually very actively involved in developing AI, other technologies inside of Russia. And Greff is definitely, you could call this guy a futurist, absolutely a technocrat. He wrote the foreword to Klaus Schwab's The Fourth Industrial Revolution, or one of his books. I might be wrong with that, but it was the one that Schwab published before COVID. So I don't remember which one that was. Anyway, he wrote the Russian language foreword to that book. Anyway, they're pretty tight, I would say. He was also a former, he was on the board of directors or whatever it's called, the WEF before the SMO kicked off. So anyway, Sber is always very actively involved each year in SPIEF. They always have their own little panels and weird gimmicks that they do, and et cetera, et cetera. And Greff, of course, was in St. Petersburg for the conference. And it was reported that on one of these, I believe it must have been one of these panels, I'm going to assume, because Sber had its own special panel, and he brought up the possibility, or maybe even the hope, that at some point Russia could actually use artificial intelligence to carry out basically a lot of what I guess you would call public administration. So just number crunching or maybe just routine paperwork or data processing, et cetera, et cetera. I guess the quote here is, what did he say? Yeah, he basically said, like, in public administration, you can give, it's possible to give decision making to artificial intelligence systems. And I mean, my piece was sort of tongue in cheek because it just sort of pointed out that Greff is up to his usual trickery. But then I also just sort of jokingly noted that because Russia has such a massive bureaucracy, like, this would actually probably put a lot of people out of work. And obviously there are a lot of, I mean, serious reasons why such a plan would backfire. But I just thought that it might be interesting to people to know that Hermann Greff wants to replace Russia's public administrators with computers.
Yes, he said in part, quote, "In general, all management is built on two components. The first is data-based management. This part of management is rational. It is best, especially in public administration, to give decision making to artificial intelligence systems." And you wrote that Greff also argued that one of the main advantages of using what you term Greff bots, AI, to administer Russia was that you wouldn't be able to bribe them. So this is one of the sales pitches for so-called artificial intelligence or machine intelligence, is that not only will it make life more convenient, but it will do away with corruption. And perhaps there are some who are seeking to make convenience more widespread and corruption less widespread, and some who are genuinely trying to create health or medical benefits with artificial intelligence. I don't think for a moment that everybody involved with artificial intelligence has nefarious plans, but like with the allopathic medical system, the totality of the way it's driving is the negative way it's driving is so powerful that even if you have good intentions in this system, they're going to be subsumed unless they are useful to the system. And what he's talking about here really is, it's not just replacing human beings in work capacities, but he's talking about reskilling them. And this speaks to also developing new so-called innovative finance mechanisms and new markets that are based on people as collateral. And so what are all these people out of work going to do? Well, they're going to be data mined via digital devices. They're going to be tethered to blockchains where they can earn tokens that they can cash in for food or for something else they might need. And in the minds of people like Hermann Greff, this is all in service of, and you make reference to Skynet in this piece, but these people really believe in that, and that is what they're trying to create. They're trying to create what Oliver Reiser wrote about in the earlier half or perhaps the mid 20th century, the world sensorium, or a global brain that is based on data that's mined from as many people as possible. And then it's not just to mine that data and build this global brain, but turn it into a commodity mechanism, a commodifying mechanism. And so, yes, this is a tongue-in-cheek piece, but you're talking about something very serious here that has horrific implications for not just Russians, but all of humanity.
Yeah, and I mean, I would go on to point out that unfortunately this is not even, I mean, it's bad, but I don't even know if it would rank as top three of Graf's like worst ideas. I mean, this guy is just every sort of technocratic and dystopian thing that Russia, you know, is floating as a policy or has even already enacted. Graf has absolutely had some level of involvement in, and sometimes he's directly responsible for it. So it's really important that when Graf says something crazy that you take it seriously, because this guy usually gets what he wants.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up toward the end of this piece, you ask the question, have you ever observed someone who has free time? And so you're talking here about people who would be put out of work, at least put out of arguably real labor by artificial intelligence. And I think this is an important point, because what people like Graf and many others are seeking to do with people who have a surplus of so-called free time is not just ignore them or let them go off into their digital la-la lands, but to mine them for data while they're in those digital la-la lands. And there are even people who talk about extracting energy from people's brain waves, using the energy created by the electricity in the brain and harnessing that to be used for production in the digital sphere. It sounds ridiculous, but there are people at MIT talking about this, people at other similar institutions talking about this, and impact investors are talking about this as well. And this is what is really at the heart of sustainable development goals and creating social impact through investing. It's based on digging into people's behavior, primarily by digital means, manipulating that behavior, predicting that behavior, steering that behavior, and then commodifying that behavior.
I believe everything you just said. This sounds terrifying. You know what I would say just really quickly is, like, so one of the things that I sort of touch on in the article, and again, sort of not in a very serious way, I admit, is there's a very popular theory, and I think this is especially pushed by people who like this kind of stuff, like using AI and et cetera, is that, okay, there's going to be all these people who are unemployed, but that's okay, because we'll have UBI and now people can fulfill their dreams and fulfill themselves, you know, they're find out who they really are, and they won't have to be tied down to a stupid 40-hour week job that they don't like. And it's like, guys, I'm sorry to be such a buzzkill, but I don't think that they're doing this so that you can find yourself, right? It's like, right. That's not the point here. I'm sorry. Like, I'm really, really sorry, but I don't think that's the point. I don't think that's the main objective. If people are able to use this system to actually sort of escape, you know, wage slavery, that's great. Except, of course, UBI and any other sort of system they're going to use to make you dependent on them, I don't think that's going to end very well. And also it's soul crushing. Has all sorts of effects on how we're going to relate to one another, how we're going to relate to authority, what we're going to be able to say, or what we can do, what we can eat, where we can go, what we can think. It's not going to be pretty, right? I'll just put it that way. And so when, you know, that's the problem here. And look, again, I sort of make fun of it, but okay, I get it. Like, Russia's bureaucracy does suck. And yes, there is a lot of corruption. But, you know, there's a huge slippery slope here. And once you start saying, we need AI because it's more effective and more convenient. You can use that argument to do very, very terrible things, you know? And it always starts with something really simple. Our mutual friend Marco, just really quickly, he once made the argument to me when COVID hit. And he was like, you know what? We can trace all of this back to when government started banning indoor smoking. He's like, that's when we should have known that the global dystopian health, you know, dictatorship was coming. And he's sort of right, you know? And it's like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was in 2006 here in New York and New Jersey. And that was largely driven by, I want to say, Bloomberg, although I don't know if he was mayor of New York yet.
It might have been. That sounds right. Maybe someone replaced him. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. If it was Bloomberg, it makes a lot of sense because he's very much into the type of global economic restructuring that I was talking about. That sounds like madness, but if you research it, this is going on. And that brings me back to the point that what we're talking about here is not just AI. We're talking about global economic and monetary policy restructuring. And AI is merely a part of that. It's a means to an end. It's not the end itself, I would argue. Just like the war is a means to an end. It's not an end itself. And I think that's right. What we
they have
need
no
to
intrinsic
keep...
value. They have no intrinsic value. That just AI a war, it doesn't mean anything. What are they used for? What are their ends?
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll once again say that we need to remember that in our analyses and look primarily through that lens. And things will start to make a lot more sense. And we'll be doing a lot more justice, I think, to the people who are being slaughtered by what's been happening since, well, February 24th of last year, but well before that. Riley, as you can hear from the tunes, we are up to time, but I thank you as always for joining me. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to our next discussion.
Thanks for having me back, Jesse. It was great talking.
Absolutely. And that's it for me for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned for Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio. Take care.